KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today, I'm excited to continue a discussion that we've had with several guests on the show involving collaborative development of products and collaborative development generally. Throughout the two-year or so history of Hearsay Culture, we've had several guests on to deal with these issues. Among them has been Professor Hank Chesbrough from UC Berkeley Haas School of Business, who's written both Open Business Models and Open Innovation, two fascinating books examining issues of collaborative development. We've also had Michelle Bowens of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation discussing peer-to-peer development, as well as Professor Larry Lessig and others discussing peer development generally. Today, I'm very excited to have on Jeff Howe of Wired, who has written a fascinating new book called Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business. Jeff's book takes a far-reaching examination of a number of new data points that we have over the last few years to suggest different ways that community development, community innovation is being used, not only in businesses, but as well as generally in the world of innovation. So when we think about crowdsourcing, what do we mean? Well, we're talking about individuals banding together in various ways, using technology and perhaps not using technology, to create new products, create new services, create new modes of communication, and so forth. And Jeff's book continues in a line of a few recent books, among them Clay Shirky, who will be on the show, who authored Here Comes Everybody, that take a look at this phenomena and try to develop some contours for it. What is it capable of doing? What is it not capable of doing? How utopian are we in our thinking about these things and other challenges to these questions? When we think about crowdsourcing, of course, we have this image, and in fact, it's something that is fairly well known in the technological world, but we think of something like the Free Software Foundation, or we think about open source software. The idea being that people create without locking down their creation through intellectual property or other contractual rights. Crowdsourcing can be the polar opposite, and of course the question is whether crowdsourcing and intellectual property rights or contracts are in tension. And that's something that we're going to be discussing as we think about these issues. Not only is crowdsourcing an idea, but one of the interesting things that Jeff does in his book is look at other aspects of community innovation. So he discusses things like crowdfunding, for example, something that is particularly present today as we've just finished a presidential election. The idea of crowds getting together, individuals getting together to fund projects. And the idea, of course, as consumers, as creators. All of these ideas we're going to explore over the next hour or so in Hearsay Culture. And just by way of brief background for Jeff, for those of you that aren't familiar, he is a contributing editor at Wired Magazine, where he covers the entertainment industry, among other subjects. Before coming to Wired, he was a senior editor at Inside.com and a writer at The Village Voice. In his 15 years as a journalist, he's traveled around the world working on stories ranging from the impending water crisis in Central Asia to the implications of gene patenting. He's also written for U.S. News & World Report, Time Magazine, The Washington Post, Mother Jones, and numerous other publications. Without further ado, Jeff, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff, let's start off. I've talked a little about your background here, but I always like to ask my authors, tell us more about your background and how it led to your interest in crowdsourcing.
through the best of all possible routes, I suppose, serendipity. I actually started my professional career as an art critic. I had studied journalism and art history, and my intention was, although I'd done a fair bit of general journalism, my intention was really to go into art criticism and curation. And after a couple of years of doing that in New York, essentially became disillusioned with the small conversation that entails, which is to say, it's a very limited number of people you're really writing for as an art critic, and began to move into a more general journalism, and journalism, especially in New York, being a bit of a hard field to break into, I really just stumbled into technology. I had written a piece for the technology editor at she'd been guest editing the sports column, and I'd written a piece on skateboarding. And she said, "You know, we really need technology writers. What do you know about technology?" Knowing nothing whatsoever, I answered, "A lot. You should hire me." And so I started writing a regular column there. And I did that for a couple years, and I have to say, still felt like I was bluffing. And then had about a year at Inside.com, and now I've been at Wired for about 8 years. And there are still times I feel like I'm bluffing. So, my focus at Wired, I sometimes joke, in 8 years of being there, I've never written a story about computers, which is entirely true. Wired's a wonderful place because we really, it really allows us to focus on such, abstract concepts as change and the future. And it's really a wonderfully idea-driven magazine. And a lot of what my interest is lies in how technology has affected the media and entertainment industries. I'll wrap it up and just sort of lead us into crowdsourcing. But I in 2005, I'd been writing about MySpace, and this is actually before MySpace was known, before it was a household term. And when it was known mainly as a way for bands like punk rock bands to circumvent the label system and sort of go directly to the fan and build their own fan networks, and so I was sort of writing about disintermediation on MySpace, and that led me in spending time with this demographic. I really saw that there was a fundamental shift headed our way in the way that they were using media creation tools. And their relationship with media, and that led to the birth of the theory of crowdsourcing. And then at that point, I was able to get a green light on the feature for Wired, which is a bit like having a grant approved. I mean, because you're going to spend 3 or 4 months working on it, so it can be laborious. But and then I found examples that backed up this theory, and because it was a hypothesis at first, and it sort of became theory through the process of a lot of reporting. So that's how I wound up with crowdsourcing.
That's great, and it is an answer to my question. So we have plenty of time to have these discussions. It's interesting. You mentioned serendipity as being largely the root, because to a certain degree, I got into entertainment and IP litigation through the benefit of being a junior level associate looking for a lateral position right during the dot-com bubble, when associates were leaving law firms to make fortunes. And I got fortunate enough to be hired at Prior Cashman, which is a firm known for IP and entertainment that would not normally have been looking necessarily for someone with my background, which was not in IP and entertainment as much as it was just being a litigator. So it's interesting how serendipity fits in, and actually it does tie in that idea to the idea of crowdsourcing because of these serendipitous connections that can occur in these synergies that we wouldn't otherwise identify. And I am curious to ask you along those lines, how as your experience as a journalist has impacted your analysis, and perhaps the way to get into that is, for those that aren't familiar, to just give us the basic definition of crowdsourcing, which I think is suggested in your subtitle. But how do you define crowdsourcing, and how does being a journalist fit into your analysis?
Well, I actually like your definition better than mine. It's funny, I was thinking that as you introduced the show. I mean, when we pursued the article, we were careful to draw a very strict line around what might be and what would not be crowdsourcing, and so we define it as the act of taking a job once performed by employees and outsourcing it to a large undefined group of people in the form of an open call, usually over the internet. And I can dig into that a little bit, but basically the idea was to separate the companies who were quite consciously and explicitly replacing people. I mean, not necessarily in the form of layoffs, but But, you know, maybe it could be through user-generated advertising, you know, or product development. But they were actually, you know, taking functions that had once been performed by not necessarily just employees, but designated agents. So, you know, a freelancer or an independent contractor. And getting it done through the fruits of the crowd. I mean, just opening it up in the form of this open call. But what's happened since that article came out, and certainly since the book has come out, is that, you know, that term crowdsourcing has acquired a life of its own. You know, and I can define the word some in one way, but it'll give me the credibility to sort of monitor the Wikipedia page on it. But that's about it. I mean, how people use it is up to them. And so people have really come to include not just the act of a company organizing a crowdsourcing effort, but really communities organizing, you know, on their own to perform functions that were once performed by employees. And you alluded to that in your introduction.
The idea of crowdsourcing, actually, and as I think about these topics, I think about it in the context of previous discussions we've had on Hearsay Culture with peer-to-peer theorists. And so perhaps I'll ask you kind of a lead-in question this way. Does crowdsourcing, as you see it, require the use of technology?
I'm sorry, can you just repeat that, David?
Sure. Does crowdsourcing itself require the use of technology? In other words, do we need to have the internet? Do we need to have these new modes of creation and communication? Or does crowdsourcing suggest something broader to you about how people work together, even absent technology itself?
Sure. I mean, yeah, it absolutely suggests something broader. I mean, I don't think of crowdsourcing as anything terribly new or terribly unique. In fact, you know, the first instance I cite in my book, although I don't know if it actually is the first, I kind of doubt it, is the Longitude Prize when the British Admiralty offered £10,000, about $12 million today, for anyone who could crack the nuts of longitude, who could, you know, help, you know, British navigators determine longitude when they were sailing, you know, that problem being at the root of you know, an enormous amount of, you know, lost tonnage in terms of shipping and also naval vessels as well. So, you know, it was sort of the scientific pickle of its day, and some of the best scientific minds of that period had really, you know, butt their heads against that wall unsuccessfully, and it was eventually solved by an uneducated cabinet maker, John Harrison, from Yorkshire, England. So it's you know, it's a really neat precedent because it foreshadows, you know, a lot of what we see today in crowdsourcing. But, you know, in that people who you don't think are going to be qualified to do something, in fact, are able, they bring their diverse knowledge set to a task and thus are actually, in fact, uniquely qualified to solve it. In John Harrison's case, it's because he was a clockmaker and he understood clocks in a way that none of the scientists had. And, you know, so he was able to make a chronometer. You know, however, obviously they didn't have the internet in 1714. So, you know, it's, there's nothing, you know, all, the only technology we need is some form of mass communication, to facilitate the open call. I mean, the open call is basically an audition. You know, I have this job that needs to be done. Who can do it? And it, what happened though is, you know, that was difficult and onerous before the internet, and it became or expensive. I mean, you could say do that through a newspaper. The Help Wanted ad is essentially a form of crowdsourcing. Mm-hmm. You know, you could do it on TV as well, but these are all, you know, fairly expensive. You know, access to you know, the megaphone of mass media was expensive before the internet, and the internet made it really cheap. And as such, the internet made organization, you know, really easy and really cheap, and it facilitated the gathering of online communities. And these are really sort of petri dishes for crowdsourcing. Are these online communities? So, the internet is not necessary for crowdsourcing, but it has greatly facilitated it.
Now, your book, as I mentioned in the introduction, I think does a wonderful job of bringing together a number of different stories of different efforts to bring individuals together to create. And I think that's, of course, a testimony to being a journalist that you bring all these perhaps divergent stories together to weave a narrative. And in that sense, is there something that, or what you traditionally call a thesis in your book? And if there is one, what would it be? What are you trying to achieve, or what main point are you trying to get across in crowdsourcing?
I'd say, I really wanted to do some simple things well in the book. It was my first book. I felt that the subject matter was complex, and that a lot of people would be very unfamiliar with the idea, and that it was and remains a bit of a radical idea. And so the thesis is very simple. It's A, this is happening, and B, I guess, watch out, in a good way and a bad way. So I both wanted to convince the reader that this is a robust phenomenon, that it has gained purchase in a broad number of industries. So a lot of effort went into trying to do, fairly careful, popular case studies. I mean, not case studies as you would see, coming out of a business school, perhaps, but as far as popular books go, case studies that were, carefully researched and a lot of reporting to show just how significant the trend was. And then to sort of cast some light on what's coming down the pike, and that's to say that I'm ambivalent about crowdsourcing's effects. I often say I think it's a net positive on for society. I think that on the plus side, it liberates a lot of heretofore latent creative talent and intellectual talent on the part of people who it could be a photographer in rural Louisiana. It could be in fact, this is a very much a real world example. A scientist who had to drop out of his PhD program to care for an ill parent and was never able to go back, but now participates in very high level scientific problem solving process through InnoCentif, a problem solving network. So, on the other hand, I really do view crowdsourcing as very disruptive, as something that, will, and is, facilitating creative destruction in a bunch of industries. So, I wanted to get that in the book as well. So I guess that would be the thesis.
And we're talking with Jeff Howe, the author of the book Crowdsourcing. And Jeff, I do want to discuss creative destruction in the context of crowdsourcing as you define it shortly. But before we get to that, perhaps I'll ask you this follow-up question with regard to the book itself. Where do you situate crowdsourcing in the recent literature dealing with peer-to-peer and community development? As I mentioned in the introduction, I mean, you take a book like Clay Shirky's, who has yet to be on the show but will be, or you take work on a more theoretical level about peer-to-peer that's been written by people like Larry Lessig and Michelle Bowens. Where do you situate crowdsourcing in terms of that recent development of serious empirical analysis as well as sociological analysis of this phenomena?
I really limited my ambitions to when I sold the book, and even actually when I was first writing the book proposal, I thought, how does my book exist in a world with Yochai Benkler's Wealth of Networks, or even his earlier essay, Coase's Penguin, which is an analysis of what more or less what the internet does to Ronald, the economist Ronald Coase, and his essay, The Nature of the Firm. And I really came down to answer, do we need a journalist in this field? And I decided the answer was yes. And So that's to say that it put me in a uniquely beneficial. It gave me a really nice advantage in that I there was no onus on me to duplicate the efforts of thinkers like Yochai Benkler and Clay Shirky or Lawrence Lessig. But it gave me an opportunity to see how their theories were being applied by, more or less to generalize people who certainly have never even heard of them. Mm-hmm. And so that was really neat. I mean, the model became more, books on, I guess I could say, trade nonfiction on ideas or the idea book genre. So, I was looking at ways that say James Sawicki or Malcolm Gladwell or my editor-in-chief, Chris Anderson at Wired, have been able to take ideas that don't necessarily fit neatly into any category. I mean, my book is kind of a business book. It was certainly marketed that way. It's kind of a technology book. Certainly crowdsourcing, appeals largely to people with some background in technology, but I don't consider it either of those. I mean, it's a very, it's a book about people and the things that people do. And so I'm really a storyteller, and so it was really, the book in terms of how it fits with the rest of the literature is, was meant to be very much a report from the front lines, mm-hmm. meant to be a work of journalism.
Jeff, let's get into the book, and I think the way to do that and to get to some of these stories that you tell is kind of a somewhat backwards way. We're recording this interview in middle November, and the book itself is a recent book, but we know a lot of recent developments, and because of the way that technology moves and the way businesses are operating, especially in an uncertain economic climate, we could come up with more and more stories of crowdsourcing. To situate this type of innovation and community development for those that aren't familiar, what would be the most prevalent example of crowdsourcing that people who are not technologists, as you mentioned, or business people or theorists or so forth, would say, huh, I didn't know that that was an example of this phenomenon?
Let me make sure I have your question straight.
Well, sure.
What example of crowdsourcing would surprise people?
Yeah, basically, yeah, and one that people who are not technologists or business people or
sure.
what have you might be familiar with.
Well, I mean, I guess I'd say a bunch of examples, sort of quickly and see if they fit. I mean, I use Wikipedia a lot because it's, perhaps that wouldn't surprise people. I mean, for people who don't know the term, it's a great citation because
right.
Citation's a wonky word for what I mean. But it's a great example. In fact, I often say that the I have a what I call the cocktail version of the crowdsourcing definition.
Sure,
it's Wikipedia for everything.
Uh-huh.
I discovered that I live in New York and it's a fairly literate culture here, but even here, people. When they hear you're working on a book, they sort of, roll their eyes. I mean, not actually, but in their heart of hearts, they don't really want to know what you're working on, but they will always politely ask. So
right.
I figured I had about 2.5 seconds to explain it before conversation moved on. So they would say, oh, you coined a word. What is crowdsourcing?
Like,
it's Wikipedia for everything else. And that works wonders. People get it right away.
And then they move on to the pigs in a blanket or what have you.
Everyone knows without knowing, though, is iStockPhoto. Because iStockPhoto has become photographs licensed through that agency are so prevalent that everyone has seen those photographs, whether or not they've actually heard of iStockPhoto.
So again, just to expand this a little bit, so what is iStockPhoto and how does it exemplify crowdsourcing?
I was hoping you would ask.
Yes, there it is.
So iStockPhoto was started in before I go into the history, just the quick gloss. iStockPhoto is a stock photo agency. Stock photos being pre-shot photos that are then licensed for use by everyone from websites to newspapers and magazines, advertising companies, design firms are laying out, say, annual reports. In the past I've called it, it's the dirty white lie of the publishing industry that, you see these photos everywhere and you think that they were shot for the purpose that, the context in which you encounter them. In fact, they've been used over and over and again. So, if you are looking carefully, you'll notice that, the same shot of, a bunch of multicultural, students of varied races that you encounter in your daughter's, college brochure, will pop up again, a few days later somewhere else. So, at any rate, when iSat Photo was being started, the average cost to license one of these images was around $250, $300 and upwards. So, Bruce Livingstone, who was a web designer living in Calgary, didn't want to have to pay that all the time. He was a web designer, but a lot of his work would be for friends, and he was a musician, and so he would sort of do pro bono website design or flyer design for other bands, and rather than have to pay that for a project that he wasn't going to make up anything off of anyway, he decided he would start this site called iStockPhoto, and the whole point would be, he would load up all of his images. He had about 10,000 digital images, and while they weren't very good, a lot of them were usable. So he figured that there were other designers out there like him who were in the same boat, and so that if all they had to do was upload their own image bank, and then they were free to download, for every image they uploaded, they could then download, I think, like three images. And so you had this, it's sort of a classic example of the gift economy that sprung up on the internet, where people give and yet also receive. And the only reason it changed, sort of what I think of as Bruce's fateful decision, is that he could no longer afford to pay the hosting costs. This was, the site had become so popular that all these, good sized digital images, were hogging up his server. So to pay for the hosting costs, he started charging a quarter. And so people no longer had to upload their own photos to download, and suddenly it just became a commerce site. And word got out that there was, some pretty decent images at the site, and you could save, he was literally undercutting traditional stock agencies by 99%. And so word got around through clients that there was incredible way of saving money, and work got around with amateur photographers that there was a place where you could actually get your work published and also receive a small supplementary income. And so it became very popular with both groups of people, on the client side and the photographer side. So now there's some 50,000 photographers. 96% of them do not claim photography as their primary means of income, which is to say they're amateurs. And it makes an enormous amount of money. It's terrifically successful. Last year I don't know their 2008 numbers, and I never will because they won't release them. But Getty, which owns them now, released their 2007 figures. They made $72 million in 2007 with a profit margin of over 50%.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, and all that really on the backs of the crowd. I mean, that's sort of not quite the right way to put it, I suppose, but it is crowd-derived value.
We are talking to Jeff Howe of Wired Magazine, author of the book Crowdsourcing, here on Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you would like to make a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of ways to do it. First, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Option two is to email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Especially in these lean economic times, certainly public radio is a valuable resource, and I hope that you enjoy listening to KZSU beyond Hearsay Culture for its diverse programming. And to that end, I do hope that you consider making a donation to KZSU. For those of you that listen by podcast, it's important to remember that KZSU is the home base of Hearsay Culture, and KZSU at Stanford University is the place where Hearsay Culture can be heard first and will be heard as long as I do the show, and certainly as long as KZSU would have me. So with that in mind, I do hope that you consider making a donation to KZSU. Jeff, let's the story you just told is a very remarkable one, especially as I mentioned, in times where literally today and tomorrow Congress is weighing whether to bail out the auto industry. When you hear 50% profit margins, that's eye-popping in any economic climate, but especially now. And it does lead to, I think, to a logical follow-up question, which when you hear numbers like that, you think, well, why isn't everyone doing this? I mean, why wouldn't all businesses attempt to come up with a model that leverages the crowd? And yet, we still have, I think, as a society, or at least people that think about it, they think, well, wait a minute, you can't have crowdsourcing, you can't have collaborative development, and at the same time control your intellectual property and have contractual rights. So how does crowdsourcing fit into the more prevalent, or maybe not, and you could tell me, at least historically more prevalent business model of locking down your property and in that way harnessing whatever profits or resources can be derived from them?
Very, very awkwardly, is what I would say. There's sort of a couple questions embedded in your question. And the first is, why isn't everyone doing it? And the short answer, maybe we can return to this, is because it's really hard. And because mm-hmm. it's of limited applicability. It works great with photography. Somewhat for reasons that have to do, that are very much particular to the field of photography, and somewhat for reasons that have nothing to do with photography and have everything to do with, the declining cost of digital tools, media production tools, et cetera. But to sort of skip ahead and address the IP question, and it's very much related, we have not, there is no stand, just as we're seeing a shift in copyright regimes generally, or at least attitudes toward them, if not a legal reflection of that. We are also seeing a lot of tumult in crowdsourcing in terms of how intellectual property is regarded. To the extent that there's a prevailing model, it's the crowd just simply sacrifices their intellectual property. But I don't see that I'm fairly certain that that is going to change. I think that as crowdsourcing models become more ubiquitous, as more economic value is derived out of them, I think that the crowd is going to get smarter, and they're going to want to eat one of two things. Either they're going to want the value of their IP, or what I think is we'll see even more in the near term, and to some extent we see it already, that they'll want to see that it receives more of sort of a Creative Commons treatment. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people's attitudes is, I don't mind giving this to you, but you can't just go and make a quick buck off it. Like, you have to, like, I will share it freely with you, but I expect you to share it freely with others as well. Mm-hmm. I think there's a real skepticism that people have toward companies that fairly brazenly, want to profit off the IP generated by contributors, and good with reason. And with good reason. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone likes to feel like they're a sucker. I mean, one of the most interesting areas of, and here I start to skip ahead to something else, and I don't want to do it prematurely, but I'll just close by saying one of the most interesting, and I think the most pressing area of research into, I won't say crowdsourcing, I'll say, open innovation, open systems, sort of, you know, any number of adjectives that are now that you could you know use is this idea of motivations and mm-hmm. and why do people contribute to these collaborative projects, you know, in such great numbers and with such great fervor, and what we know is that it's complicated. And that it's a lot of reasons, and many of those reasons, most of those reasons, are not monetary in nature. They're not commercial in nature. Or they may actually be commercial, but they're, at any rate, not monetary.
Well, and that idea is certainly reflected in the Creative Commons license, where you are ascribing certain values to what you think is important to whatever you have created. So, as you know, you can set up a Creative Commons license that asks merely for attribution, or one that says, well, I want attribution, and if you use this, you can't sell it. Or you can use it, but you have to share it just as you receive the information, and so forth. Which kind of gets to back to this idea, which I started with, in this question, I do want to focus on the limits of crowdsourcing. When the examples that you give involve both small companies that we haven't heard of and large companies like Procter & Gamble. So what is the ultimate limit of crowdsourcing today? Where is it ultimately confined, and are there examples of industries or businesses where the crowdsourcing model could not be used in any form?
Well, I think it's very tough. It's very difficult to draw the lines that common sense might dictate. You know, it's very tough to say, well, small companies can do this and big companies can't, because we know that they both can. It's tough to say that media companies can do this, but consumer products companies can't, because in fact they both can do it. You know, crowdsourcing is itself a bit of a misnomer, because it's really an umbrella term for a bunch of different strategies which share in common that root definition, that there is a you know, that fundamentally the process involves an open call to, you know, undefined groups of people. And so its limits have less to do with you know, sort of traditional, you know, any kind of traditional taxonomy we might create, that, you know, of well, these are information age industries and these are industrial age industries, and so the, you know, car makers can't crowdsource. Well, you know, the fact is that, I mean, that actually starts to come close to where we can draw a line, but the fact is that there's no such thing as an industrial age industry anymore. I mean, they're all information age industries. And to the extent that a company traffics in bits and bytes, it can probably, you know, to the extent that it has a brand that, you know, the value of which, you know, has to be maintained and is constantly, you know, under revision out in the public, you know, all of these things open it up for crowdsourcing opportunities. I mean, you know, Ford Motors might be in, at least as of this week, you know, be in the business of making cars, but, you know, it also has to create advertisements, and it has marketing plans, and it has to innovate those cars, which involves ideas, and ideas that can be broken into bits and bytes. And so, you know, where we can begin to draw some lines on what does and doesn't work is, you know, people contribute to crowdsourcing projects, you know, if we could, again, this gets in this aforementioned tricky area of motivations, but one thing that we can begin to say is there's generally passion there. The people are passionate about the people they're crowdsourcing for, you know, that there's an end that very much justifies the means in their mind. You know, there could be, you know, a form of altruism, or the process that they're engaged in is something that they're very passionate about. And so when a project does not inspire that passion, it can be very difficult to motivate people. Mm-hmm. And so there are all sorts of circumstances. You know, a semi-notorious one being, for instance, when Heinz decided to crowdsource its TV advertisement. But because people aren't necessarily passionate about ketchup, and they're not necessarily passionate about making an ad, which is you know, fairly circumscribed by a major consumer products company like Heinz, then you know, all Heinz was left with was really just offering money. Mm-hmm. And so they got a lot of fairly, you know, well, first and foremost, they had to hire an ad agency just to create the ads telling people that they wanted people to make an ad. And then they were overloaded with responses, but so few of them were usable that they had to hire another agency just to wade through all these terrible attempts at a commercial just to find one or two that were any good. And last I looked, they had come up with a couple that were good, but I would be surprised to find out that the people who made them weren't in one way or another professionals, with some experience in professional video production at least, and that there hadn't been a fair amount of guidance and doctoring on the part of Heinz. I mean, I think they sort of had to salvage that effort.
Right.
And so, you know, it doesn't always work. In fact, I think crowdsourcing often, even in areas where you would think it would might go off like gangbusters, if the community isn't managed correctly. I mean, if they're not treated respectfully, if the company doesn't approach them with a fair amount of humility and transparency, then the project fails. And so that's where we see the limits of crowdsourcing.
We're talking with Jeff Howe of Wired Magazine, author of the book Crowdsourcing, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. You know, you mentioned earlier in the interview, Jeff, that crowdsourcing takes different formats and there's different ways that it can be used. And in fact, you use another phrase, crowdfunding, as one example. What is crowdfunding, and how does that relate to this general phenomena that you identify and expose in the book?
Well, so really quickly, it might help. I mean, I create, in the book, I try to specify that there are four categories of crowdsourcing,
right,
as I identify it, and I think it reflects a growing consensus as well, and that's that there are forms of crowdsourcing that are really what we would call, to tap collective intelligence or wisdom of the crowds, and that might be a prediction market or a problem-solving network that, is basically depending on things that people already know, and that they can fairly quickly communicate usually. So, a stock market, a simple, any financial market is a version of this because it's tapping, it's using the crowd to determine a price point. And that could be a futures market like, Iowa electronic markets, which, traffic in, futures for presidential elections, are various other manifestations of that. And then there is sort of tapping of crowd's creative ability and what the crowd can create. And that's what you would say iStock Photo is, because they're actually producing objects are goods. It's not just their knowledge, but what they can do with their knowledge. And then there is, what I call, the crowd filter or tapping the crowd, powers of judgment or their opinions. And this we see everywhere from, Google PageRank is a version of this, where information is organized by, the choices people make in terms of what they link to. Thus expressing their judgment that most emailed sidebar on NewYorkTimes.com, NYTimes.com, which filters all of the many stories offered every day on the New York Times by what people have chosen to read or what people have chosen to email. So finally, this fourth category is crowdfunding, and that is a category of crowdsourcing in which people's wallets are tapped. And in a lot of ways, it's the very simplest aspect of crowdsourcing. I've got a lot of examples in the book, but the one that is as you sort of hinted at in the beginning of the program, is U.S. President-elect Obama and his ability to, tap 3 million donors for $660 million an enormous base of contributors. And what I say on my blog is that, he is the first crowdfunded presidential candidate, and that by being quantitatively different, he became qualitatively different. That, I mean, you could argue, with some justification that all political candidates are crowdfunded. You really see it with Barack Obama, because so many people came together to fund him with small donations. That really wasn't a matter of, it almost only could have been done over the internet.
It's a fascinating area, and of course now we see that one of the issues that the Obama transition team is dealing with, according to press reports, is what to do with this group of donors once the president is the president. And do you simply let this group of donors just fade into the woodwork, or is there a way to use this newly formed group to further policies and so forth once President-elect Obama becomes President Obama? And I guess that leads me in the last 7 or so minutes that we have to a couple of follow-up questions, which is the group itself, does it require, in your view, a leader? I mean, we think about groups of people historically as having a leader, someone that's directing the activity. And yet many of the examples that you identify in your book and explain don't appear to have a clear leader, and especially in their inception. I mean, a group of people come together, and maybe one person takes a first step in coalescing this group, but it doesn't suggest that that person is the leader of it. So as we think about traditional ways that businesses create and that business models have been developed, is hierarchy and leadership something necessary for crowdsourcing?
This is a complex one. I don't think that a leader is necessary for a crowdsourcing effort to come off, but it depends greatly on the complexity of the project. One of the rules in my book, the last chapter, so the rules of crowdsourcing, says that in fact you do need a leader. It's in open source software, it's the benevolent dictator principle. It's this idea that you need a Linus Torvalds, the open source programmer for which Linux is named after, of course, to be the decider, be the man or the woman who, and says, you're all giving great, great ideas. However, I'm not going to take your advice because I just simply don't think it's going to work. I'm going to side with the minority. We saw this during Obama's campaign when he decided to support a slightly altered version of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Services Act. And is that right? Is that what FISA stood for?
Yeah, the Foreign Intelligence Services Act, right?
Okay, so I knew the acronym, but you're the lawyer, so you'd be all fact-checking.
Right.
For a while, the largest number of posts, the greatest activity on mybarackobama.com was the protest group saying, don't do it. He was open source enough to not shut that down and, in fact, valued it, and also posted a very careful, published a very well thought out post explaining the nuances of why he was supporting it. But in the end, he made his own decision. And that's not to say, I mean, perhaps that's a bad example because I there are people who say that this was a crowdsourced campaign. I don't quite go that far. I think it was unprecedented in its use of social media. I don't think that you can say that his campaign was crowdsourced.
Mm-hmm.
But what I will say, going back to the question of what does he do with this vast network of, millions of hardcore supporters, of people who he certainly will want to have around in 2012, is he's either going to have to put them to work or they'll do it themselves. And to that extent, it's almost like we could say, do the communities need a community manager or a leader? I think they do. I think they need some sort of hub, even if it's a temporary hub. I mean, I think what we see in the internet is communities pool around an axis for a while, and then they disperse and they repool around another one. So I think that there's a lot of fluidity. I mean, that there is demonstrably a lot of fluidity. But they do pool. So if you don't have an access, if Obama is unable to provide, that, and to some extent it's a software question, website question. I mean, will the new WhiteHouse.gov be compelling enough to bring this community together, to give it a home on the web? I think anecdotally we can guess that it will, just because my Barack Obama was so well, I mean, his web presence was so well run, and all indications are that he will have, the smartest, it'll be the smartest tech presence here, the smartest executive branch from a, technology viewpoint ever. But if he doesn't, people will do it on their own. I mean, that we know. I mean, mm-hmm. This community, it's not that the community goes away. It will just find new axes around which to gather.
The remaining few minutes, I think I would be remiss in not asking you as a journalist a question that often comes up, which is there's been a number of books written and articles written predicting the fall of traditional media as a result of things like Wikipedia and blogs and so forth. And I think it's fair to say that blogs, especially blogs where groups of people, more than one blogger, get together, is a small example of crowdsourcing, especially if you don't throw in Google AdSense and other ways to make what could be a minuscule, but at least some stream of revenue. What's your view in a couple of minutes, really, on this position that these new technologies portend the demise of traditional media?
Well, I don't think there's any question that they portend the demise of traditional media as we know it, which is to say an ecosystem that is dominated by the networks, the big cable news programs, and the large circulation newspapers. But I disagree with those that believe that publications like the New York Times, networks like NBC, even newspapers like the Columbus Dispatch or the Cincinnati Enquirer are simply going to evaporate and are get dumped in the proverbial dustbin of history. I mean, it's just not going to happen. Those brands are too meaningful in their communities slash in the case of New York Times, because it's a national paper, to the demographic that you could almost call it its constituency, and they just have too much value. Now, does the business model change pretty dramatically? I'm pretty sure it does. Will there be a lot of blood on the floor? I'm almost, there is as of the last 2 weeks.
Right.
You're talking to me from, I'm not Condé Nast today, but my office is a Condé Nast. I mean, there are fewer people in that building right now. So, these models are changing now quickly. It was already, print advertising, the print ad dollar was on the decline anyway, and the current economic climate has greatly accelerated that decline. And it's going to force companies to create smarter models. Now, anyone who tells you they know what that model is going to be is lying. So I would be as well. But I have some ideas of what it'll look like, and I certainly think that the crowd plays a role. I don't think there's any question that if you look at something like Talking Points Memo, a left leaning blog, or really it's a news site operated by Josh Michael Marshall, that to me is the news organization of the future. I think we'll see a lot of those.
The author.
I should say what that model is. Sorry. Where you have several professionals working with, an unofficial staff, very much unofficial, of hardcore contributors, and then sort of a ring outside of that of frequent or occasional readers and contributors. but you know what you see there is instead of having producer and consumer, you have a spectrum. You have the paid producer, the unpaid producer, the mostly consumer and sometimes producer to the you know me. I never comment at CPM, but I'm probably there every day.
Right, the lurker. Yes. Yeah, the author is Jeff Howe. The book is Crowdsourcing, Why the Power of the Crowd is Driving the Future of Business, published by Crown Business. Jeff, it's a fascinating area, and obviously crowdsourcing is going only become more prevalent in business and community development generally. Very quickly, for those people that want to learn more about your work, obviously you write at Wired and you have your book. Where can people go?
Crowdsourcing.com. I was smart enough to buy the domain when my article first came out.
Excellent, yes,
so,
yes.
It's on hiatus this month, but I'm actually about to post my first, I'm off vacation officially as of today, so.
Fair. Well, welcome back.
And
I hope you enjoyed your vacation, and I appreciate you you ending your vacation with a discussion here on Hearsay Culture, and I do invite you back to join us in the future. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
So we are looking forward on Hearsay Culture. I'm certainly looking forward to a number of guests that I have coming on in the remaining few weeks of the fall quarter of KZSU. The show will be in hiatus during KZSU's interim. So there are a couple more shows coming up into the beginning of December, and then the show will begin again in mid-January. Guests that are coming up not only this month but in January include Nick Carr, author of the book The Big Switch, which has a new volume coming out. Professor Ned Snow of the University of Arkansas will be on discussing internet and copyright issues. The aforementioned Clay Shirky will be on the show discussing Here Comes Everybody. Professor Murrell Hildebrandt has authored a fascinating book called Profiling the European Citizen. It's a collection of essays focusing on national identification cards in the EU. Andrew Luman and Professor Wendy Seltzer will be on discussing the Tor Project, another fascinating area involving anonymity on the internet. Professor Paul Heald from the University of Georgia will be on the show discussing copyright issues. I'm looking forward to next week to having Professor John Palfrey from the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School, or now actually Berkman Center at Harvard University, discussing his co-authored book, Born Digital. And Bob Wallace and H.K. Melton, co-authors of the book Spycraft. I'm also excited to mention that we'll be having on in the winter Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as Zohar Efroni, non-resident fellow at the Center of Fair Society, who's written some interesting work in comparative copyright law. I'm very excited to, of course, always mention that the show can be heard, Hearsay Culture can be heard through our iTunes webpage. That is Stanford Center for Internet Society iTunes webpage by typing Center for Internet Society in the iTunes search engine. You can also get the show, of course, through hearsayculture.com, where you can get this show and all previous shows and look at upcoming schedules and occasional blog posts on my part. You can also get the show through the RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And last but not least, I always encourage anyone to email me with comments, questions, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.